Hello, I am Sandra Ezekwesili, and you come to me for hard facts. The world keeps turning, and you're trying to keep up.
The fight against coronavirus has the Oxford.
But there's so much noise drowning out the news. Talking heads, broadcast messages, press releases. They're telling you their side, but you just want the facts. And that's why you come to me. I give you the statistics without spin. Out of 116 million working age Nigerians, 35.5 million are employed full time. That's 30%. I give you the context.
I give you the history.
I fight fake news with facts.
Kayode.
Let me talk.
No, Kayode, I will let you talk. Kayode. Kayode, I will let you talk if you let me talk. Kayode.
That's why more and more Lagosians are tuning in. Half a million Lagosians.
720,000.
970,000. Over 1 million Lagosians. They know that if you give me your afternoon, I will give you hard facts.
Well done, Sandra, all you do, going beyond the headlines and focus on the facts.
I am Sandra Ezekwesili, and these are your hard facts.
Hello, Lagos. Good afternoon. I am Sandra Ezekwesili, and these are your hard facts. I want to say well done to every single person who is out there today trying to make ends meet, whatever it is that you're doing, whatever the work of your hands are. I just want to let you know that I recognize how hard you're working. I see you. I appreciate you. And well done. You know, It occurs to me every time I'm coming into work and I'm seeing, especially the young people who are selling in traffic or driving buses or pushing carts, you know, just doing anything and everything to make a living, you know, or make ends meet one way or the other. And I'm just always really, you know, proud, you know, because people are choosing the hard way. They're choosing the hard way. They're choosing the tough way. They're choosing the back-breaking way to get this done. And I just really want to, you know, give you a shout out and tell you well done. You know, it probably doesn't mean much, but well done, honestly. First hard fact of the day is Divine Odudu's provisional ban. The Athletics Integrity Unit says that the sprinter has violated anti-doping rules. This is linked to the same case as Blessing Okagbare, who got an 11-year ban last year. We're going to be following that story, and as soon as we know a bit more about that situation, we'll be sharing it with you on your number one station for talk. It's really bad news for Nigerian athletics, to be honest. It's quite disappointing if the allegations are true. But like I said, we'll keep monitoring it here on Hard Facts, and you'll find out when we find out. 1 million Lagosians listen to this show. Thank you for tuning in every day. I've got a great show for you. You know it's Friday, so it's Big 3 Global Edition Day. Let's talk about the devastating earthquake in Turkey and Syria. Then let's talk about South Africa's growing energy crisis. And then let's talk about the US shooting down a Chinese balloon. At 4 o'clock, the Hard Facts Awards will take the air. It's a segment where you and I pick the most memorable stories that we covered on Hard Facts this week or every other week, you know? It's a new segment. We launched it this year. I have fun on it, and I hope you do too. On Eyes and Nays, another new segment that we launched this year, let's talk about the lawmaking process. Our guest from Order Paper will return for that segment. After that segment, Music and Moments with Ifeanyi, Sam and Dexter will take the air. Expect news, business and sports at the top of the hour every hour. But let's get started with today's Big 3 Global Edition Lagos. I'm Sandra Ezekwesili, and these are your hard facts.
The Big 3 Global Edition on Hard Facts.
Is the Turkish opposition playing politics with the earthquake or doing its job? Can South Africa emerge from its energy crisis? Is the balloon the first shot? Those are your big three, Global Edition, Lagos. Let's talk every Friday at 3. We let Nigeria rest a bit and instead we take a look at the biggest international stories of the week. And joining us to look at these stories is a very good friend of the show. He's an analyst and also a tech bro, Chief Andy Obuofor-Ibo. Good to have you on the show, sir. Welcome.
Thank you, Sandra. Great to be here.
Chief, the U.S. government has even done a temporary wave of sanctions on the Assad regime in Syria as a result of the devastating earthquake in Syria and Turkey. The death toll now stands at 21,000 with at least 80,000 injured. Most of the death and the damage is on the Turkish side of the border. Rescue efforts are ongoing around the clock. Aid is pouring in from all over the world. Tell us about this wave of a temporary wave of sanctions on the Assad regime in Syria.
Well, yeah, I think the U.S., you know, before now, obviously, the U.S. has had sanctions on the Assad regime for a long time. The U.S. Has sort of taken sides in that civil war. And so in order to protect the rebels, there have been these sanctions on Assad. But in light of the earthquake, the U.S. is relaxing those sanctions temporarily. Before now, it was you couldn't send money from the U.S. into the Assad side of Syria. You couldn't put money in businesses. They're going to do business with them, nothing. But now the U.S. is saying, you know what? Money can come in both directly as aid, but also payments for, you know, services, etc., to them, because the economy in Syria needs all the help it can get right now to get through this problem.
And it brings up a question of where politics should begin and end during these types of disasters. The Turkish opposition has been criticizing President Erdogan for what they call a poor response. Erdogan says the government is doing its best and the opposition should stop playing politics. Is there a point during situations like this where the opposition should stop criticizing? Or is that also part of what is needed to make sure that the government is doing its best indeed?
It's a good question. And it's one that, you know, brilliant people will disagree over and well-intentioned people will disagree over this. I personally am of the opinion that there is too much one-sided power in the world for us to warrant a situation where opposition stops talking. I think it's always good when the opposition talks. The government has the ability, usually, especially in countries with weaker institutions, the government always has the ability to twist and warp the narrative. So if the government really believes that the opposition is overblowing a thing or making a crisis out of a thing, the government has the resources to tell their own side and, you know, let everybody know, oh, yes, we actually are doing the best we can and this is not really our fault and people should believe. Yes, so since government has that power and those resources, then by all means, let the opposition talk. So that, and that way, what that allows us to do is avoid the situation where governments aren't being scrutinized and they are not doing the best that they can with all the powers they've been given, especially when it's lives on the line, even humanitarian crisis. So I'm never one of those people who says, oh, let everybody just like leave politics aside for now and let's get all the joint hands. I think part of joining hands is being very, very, scrutinizing the government, basically.
Okay, I'll ask you a final question and then we'll move on. We thankfully don't get earthquakes in Nigeria. Are there natural reasons why?
Well, we just sort of kind of dodged a bullet here in this country because we don't have any major fault lines running through Nigeria. You know, the surface of the earth, both sea and land, is broken up by these fault lines. You can think about it, I would say, like tiles on a floor, right? And anytime there's an earthquake, more or less, it's because two tiles are moving close to each other and the earthquakes tend to happen at the line between the two tiles, so that we call a fault line. So that's why you tend to have earthquakes in the same places over and over and over, over hundreds of years. But Nigeria isn't on one. So that's kind of one of those things we fortunately dodged.
Okay. Well, Lagos, share your thoughts on the unfolding disaster in Turkey and Syria. Also, tell us where you think the balance lies in situations like this, the balance between the need for opposition to keep government accountable and the need for the country to stick together through a disaster. I feel like this should be an I beg to differ topic. 0700-993-993-01-465-7190. We've got WhatsApp as well. WhatsApp is 080-959-75805. Let's quickly bring you our second story, where the South African president has declared a state of disaster. That's Cyril Ramaphosa. He called the energy crisis, quote, an existential threat to our economy and social fabric, end quote. South Africa generates about 29,000 megawatts of electricity, but South Africa needs a bit more than 30,000 to meet demand fully. I know. So whenever there's a shortfall, they have to do load shedding to keep the grid running. They have eight levels or stages of load shedding. And at stage one, they reduce demand on the grid by 1,000 megawatts. At stage two, it's 2,000. And so until you get to stage eight, they will keep just shedding it by 1,000. Stage eight is at 8,000 megawatts. Chief, you're hearing this 29,000, 30,000 megawatts, and I'm wondering what's going through your mind first before we even get into the mechanics of it.
Yeah, what just like made me laugh is that, so like stage four, stage five, stage six, the amount of megawatts it demand that South Africa is cutting down is more than the entire power supply from the grid in Nigeria. You know, like we are almost a rounding error when it comes to them. Like, so, like, if what they have is a crisis, then, or an emergency or a disaster, then obviously what we have is a catastrophe. So, like, if you think about it in that context, but it also makes me appreciate the fact that, you know, when we are serious about things, when people are serious, you know, they're not looking at this as a very small matter. Mm-hmm. They're looking about the fact that it's unacceptable that there's any power loss at all, which is, I think, one of the things that we just don't have that mindset.
Mm. In what other ways is their crisis different from ours? Because like you said, South Africa's capacity is so much that their shortfall is more than Nigeria's entire power supply. So in what other ways is their crisis different from ours here?
I think that's the major one. I think it also comes down to, you can look at it in terms of the root causes. So with South Africa, their problem is purely generation, right? They have one problem, really, power generation. It's not enough. With Nigeria, we have that problem. Power generation is not enough. We have additional problems. The transmission grid is terrible. Then distribution is also horrible. Then there's monetization or commercialization. We don't have meters everywhere. We don't have a system for capturing value. So like their problem is much narrower than ours.
Okay. Let's talk about this state of disaster that Ramaphosa has declared and what it means.
Yes.
So the government is taking four specific measures. Number one, they're letting more businesses buy and install generators. They can now exclude emergency services from load shedding. So places like hospitals, governments, they can now buy power from other countries. Before this, all power was coming from Eskom, the local power company. And finally, government will appoint an electricity minister to coordinate all their efforts. These all seem like stopgap measures to get power supply up for now. Will these measures achieve that?
Yes, I think, because what they're really looking for is about 5,000-6,000 extra megawatts, right? Is what they're looking for in the short term. Mm-hmm. And I think some of these will help. So, well, first of all, being able to buy power from neighboring countries could help. The question is, how much power do the neighboring countries have to give you? That's the big thing. That's one. Because, I mean, when you look around their neighbors, it's not exactly, you know, Western Europe. Then the second issue is, or rather Eastern Europe, since that's where they get their power from. Then the second one there is, that could help, is the generators, which is something, of course, we already have here. Which is the whole idea of, you know, I think anytime I can't remember if it's Ayoeko or Sam Amadi, who, whenever they come on your show, they always say, Nigeria has more than 4,000 megawatts. Nigeria has tens of thousands of megawatts, but most of it is generators.
Yes, and I think who says that.
Yes. So when you look at it that way, yes, it helps in the short term. The thing is that nobody who is serious wants a country where the power supply relies on these generating sets. It's a bad idea generally for lots of reasons. And so this is a short term, may work, but long term, they have to fix their fundamental issues, which is basically that for the last, say, 30 years, they have just failed because of corruption and ineptitude of government. ESCOM has failed to build new power plants to meet this demand, which is just like such a low-hanging fruit. You have to ask, I mean, people should be in prison for this, really.
Okay. But lasting solutions really revolve around increasing power generation. What's standing in the way of that for South Africa?
It's the corruption and ineptitude, Sandra. That's the honest answer. Because, you know, the funny thing about this is that this was predicted as far back as 1998. In 1998, it was clear, and the report within South Africa informed ESCOM, the power company, that if it didn't start building capacity then, that they would start having load shedding by 2007. And true to form, at 2007, like clockwork, was when the first set of load shedding happened. Mm. And since then, from 2007 till now, it's been getting worse. So why have they not been building the new power plants needed for? Because one of the issues is that their population has grown, mm-hmm. demand has grown, economy has grown. You need more power to service that. Mm-hmm. So you need more power plants. And in that period, I think they've only built like, is it two or three power plants at this point? And most of those very slow, cost overruns, budget inflation, very African problems. And the question is, why? Why is there so much corruption around this? Why has ESCOM suddenly lost the capacity to keep up with demand? And again, like I said, heads need to roll, and maybe something very different needs to happen.
Lagos, talk to us. 0700-993-993-993. What do you think about South Africa's disaster declaration in the power sector? Women, call us on 01465-7190. 01465-7190. We've got WhatsApp as well. WhatsApp is 080-959-75805. Now, I know you have thoughts to share. However, I've got less than a minute before I have to take a break. So let's take that break. When we come back, I will take the thoughts that you'd like to share on the show.
Group A of the I Beg to Differ Tournament of Champions has three ambitious debaters gunning for glory. Deborah Pamzat went from playoffs to runner-up in March 2022 in upset after upset. But this time, Lagos knows never to underestimate her. Chiagozie Isidore Omonna Ugu won the first ever I Beg to Differ match, beating future champion Ruth Okorocha. But he lost in the quarterfinals of that same tournament to finalist Emanuela Nadi. And now, he's in a group with the girl who beat Emanuela, Tamvita Kaushik. The first ever champion is the group's top seed. Will she retain her undefeated streak? Find out this March at the I Beg to Differ Tournament of Champions on 99.3 Nigeria Info FM and Wasobia Max TV.
I I'm Sandra Ezekwesili. It's 3:33 Lagos. Let's talk about South Africa's power problem. Cyril Ramaphosa called the energy crisis, quote, an existential threat to our economy and social fabric. South Africa generates about 29,000 megawatts of electricity, but needs a bit more than 30,000 to meet demand fully. So whenever there's a shortfall, they have to do load shedding to keep the grid running. They have 8 levels or stages of load shedding. And like I said before the break, at stage one, they reduce demand on the grid by 1,000 megawatts, stage two, 2,000, all the way until stage eight, where you have 8,000 megawatts. Chief Andy Obofor-Ebo is here with me. He's a public affairs analyst, and we've been talking about this before the break. We also talked about what happened in Syria and Turkey with the earthquake and the global response. We also talked about what the opposition is doing about the earthquake, essentially. And I remember the question I asked from that story. I asked you, do you think that there's a balance in situations where, well, situations like this, really, you know, the balance between the need for opposition to give to keep government accountable and the need for the country to stick together through a disaster? 0700-993-993-993. That's for men. Women, call us on 01465-7190. Hello. Thank you for calling us.
Hello, Sandra. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir. What's your name?
My name is Ben. I'm calling from Eba.
Welcome, Ben, from Eba.
Sandra, honestly speaking, that the power crisis, are we qualified to talk about it? I'm surprised that you just said that we should talk about it. Okay, because we are giants of Africa. Okay, no wonder. Okay. And I don't think about it. I don't know how we can talk about this thing, though. Their failure, that is there. I don't know whether next 50 years we will get to 20,000 megawatts. I don't know. Check how much we have spent from 1999 to date. Okay, look at now, Sandra. Divide that to 29,000 megawatts. So South Africa is about 60,000 people. 60 million, sorry.
Yes.
We have about 60 million.
Mm-hmm.
Nigeria is about 200 and something million.
Mm-hmm.
And we have 2,000 megawatts. And we are talking about people who are 60 million that are declaring crisis on 29,000 megawatts.
Mm-hmm.
And we are talking about, Sandra, I say, God, we finish also. One got to kill us, Sandra, please.
Okay, let's not talk about it. Okay.
Hi, Sandra.
Ben, say, hey, Jesus. Oh, my God. Chief, what do you think about Ben saying that? How dare us talk about this?
Well, how we go do now? We it's a global story. You have a case in case of emergency being declared, but it's really like, do we really have any business talking about it? I mean, yeah, I understand where it's coming from. You know?
Okay. All right. Lagos, the number to call at 0700-993-993-993. WhatsApp 080-959-75805. We've got our number for women, 01465-7190. Hello. Thank you for calling us.
Hello.
How you doing? What's your name, sir?
I'm Chinedu. I'm coming from Bariga.
Chinedu from Bariga. Welcome.
Yeah, welcome. All right. Honestly, what motivates me to call just was this, the last call I just said now. Honestly, you just speak my mind. Honestly, because I wanted to call, but I don't know what to say. But what you just said, you just speak my mind, honestly. I don't know what else to say. And that is different because someone is ahead of you, and you are talking about that person. So I don't, honestly, you just speak my mind.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Chinedu, for calling. 99.3, hello.
Good afternoon, Sandra.
Good afternoon, sir. What's your name?
This is calling from Odobolu.
Welcome, Eze, from Odobolu.
Yes, I don't think we have any right even to compare ourselves with...
we're not comparing. We're just talking about their own.
I beg. Let's bring another topic then we'll talk about it.
Eze, thanks for calling. 99.3, hello. Hello? Oh, that's unfortunate. Okay, let's move to our final story. We could not even have plenty of time. We have like 6 minutes before Ayobi takes over. And for our final story, we're traveling to the U.S. The U.S. military finally shot down the Chinese balloon. China acknowledged that the balloon was Chinese, but insists that it was a civilian airship that got blown off its course. The U.S. says it was a surveillance and spy balloon. Chief, if the U.S. really believes that this was a surveillance and spy balloon, why did it take them so long to shoot the thing down?
Yeah, that's a question that, in fact, many Republicans were asking the Pentagon. And the Pentagon gave many reasons. They said, one, first of all, they were monitoring the thing. They wanted to see exactly what it was, what its capabilities were. So they are claiming that they were studying the thing. And that's why they wanted to take as much time as possible. Two, they're also saying that at first, when it flew over Alaska, it wasn't really flying over anything critical, which gave them the chance to, like, you know, think about, well, give them the option to delay shooting it down. Mm. And then the third reason they gave was that they wanted to make sure that when it's shot down, it would not be shot down over a place that would make retrieving it difficult, because right now they retrieve parts of it for more study. Mm-hmm. They said they wanted to avoid shooting it down over the ocean, where they said if parts of the ocean that are too cold and too deep, so it would be damaged or to be inaccessible. So they were weighing, according to them, they were weighing all those reasons, and that's why they blamed.
It took it for so long. I have to mention, by the way, I'm currently watching Al Jazeera while we're talking, and I'm seeing that Al Jazeera is also talking about South Africa's load shedding. But I guess Lagos will say, Al Jazeera is in New York and Qatar. They can talk about anything they want to talk about. But back to
World Cup.
But back to the US and the balloon and China. China has spy satellites just like the US. Why would they need spy balloons?
It's a very good question, and it's something that's actually coming up a lot in defense circles and technology circles. Basically, spy satellites and spy balloons each have their pros and cons, right? Now, one, obviously, spy balloons, they're easier to control. That's the first one.
Right.
Like, you can keep them hovering over a place for a very long period of time to really study that place. Also, the less interference, you know, because they're closer to the ground, also allowing them to see a wider area, allegedly. But then also, the thing with everybody is getting spy balloons, if you can get spy balloons. Why? Because other countries are also building up anti-satellite weaponry, kinetic weapons, laser weapons that can knock out satellites. And so the US and other countries are saying, okay, while we have a concession of spy satellites, let's also get other things that also that are resistant to those anti-satellite weapons, like spy balloons. So it's an arms race, and I think the Chinese are saying that, yeah, we're in that race too.
Do you think America is politically prepared for its rivalry with China?
It's a good question. I think this thing, you know, I mean, China is speaking on this with one voice, while the U.S. Politicians are bickering on Capitol Hill. And but again, at the same time, anyone who studied U.S. history in the last 150 years will tell you that it's always like that. Before a big conflict, before World War One, the U.S. didn't seem to be on the same page. Before World War Two, same thing. Before the Gulf War, same thing. And then even before Iraq War, same thing. But then something happens, and then the entire U.S. political establishment sort of just like flips into one voice, one move, and then suddenly, bam, it's on. But usually in the lead-up, it's always a circus.
It's always like this. This week, we also saw SpaceX, an American company, say that they've cut off the Ukrainian military from using its Starlink satellites. That's even though the U.S. government is supporting Ukraine. So I wonder if you think America is showing that it may not have what it takes to use its air and space superiority effectively.
it's a fair question, because I'll tell you this much, the Chinese won't have that problem. You can imagine if now, like, a Chinese company, like, look at what happened to Jack Ma. Mm-hmm. Like, just don't align. Don't align with the Communist Party and see what happens to you.
Right.
But, of course, America has a very different view of that. Right. And so it's always harder to build. The more democratic a place is, the harder it is to build consensus.
Right.
You know, that's part of the reason why you have so many older Nigerians who are constantly going, oh, military, military, military. It's because, you know, people just like that shortcut where one person decides and everybody aligns.
Mm-hmm.
But I think something has to be said also about a system where a private company can look the government in the eye and say, yes, I know you have a military agreement with this country, but we don't want things to be done this way with our technology.
Mm-hmm.
Then maybe there's a wider conversation to be had about war powers, etc. But but let's not get it wrong. It is a disadvantage. Like, in a war situation, this means the Chinese can move faster than the Americans. So the question now is, how does the America overcome that?
Chief Andy Obofor, thank you so much for your time on the show today. He is a public affairs analyst, good friend of the show, joining us most Fridays now to take a look at global stories. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Sandra. Have a great weekend.
Okay. We have a few seconds and then we will pivot to Ayobe for ideas. I'm Sandra Ezekwesili. You're listening to Hard Facts on 99.3 Nigeria Info.
Some are calling Group B the Group of Death as they beg to defer Tournament of Champions. Hamid Olarenwaju is a past quarterfinalist and finalist and has only ever been beaten by champions. He wants revenge against Anvita Kaushik and Esther Bawaji, but first, he must make it out of this group. Redemption is also calling for Ramadan Oladipupo, the people's champion. Beaten in a controversial semi-final, he's here to prove that maybe he should have been in this group as an actual champion. But that title belongs to Ruth Okorocha. She beat the debater who beat Ramadan. Can she beat him too? Find out this March at the Ibek Tidifa Tournament of Champions on 99.3 Nigeria Info and Wazobia Max TV.